Welcome, friends. I'm Greg McKenzie, and you're listening to the Missiology Podcast post-game episode, in which Martin and I discuss his interview with Wilbert Schenck. Well, sadly, Dr. Schenck passed away on July 13th, 2021, shortly after Martin and I recorded this conversation. We mourn that loss for the missiological community and, of course, for his family and friends. And we also celebrate not only his life, but the fact that we had the chance to hear from him one more time, to record that and make that available to you. And so now, as Martin and I engage in a discussion of what the interview provoked for us, and especially the significance of Dr. Schenck's hope for the future of missiology, we offer you, in a spirit of recollection, sadness, but also gratitude and expectation, this Season 2, Episode 2, post-game discussion of Wilbert Schenck. Welcome, everyone, to the Season 2, Episode 2 post-game of the Missiology Podcast. We're here to talk a little bit more about the interview with Wilbert Schenck. I'm Greg McKenzie, the Missiology Podcast producer.
And I'm Martin Rodriguez. I have the honor of being the host, and we're happy to have you guys here. Thank you for listening in, and thank you for sharing as well. So let's talk about Wilbert Schenck. First of all, I loved this interview. I really enjoyed, I enjoyed the stories. The story that really caught me, Greg, it was the story of John Howard Yoder standing up in Karl Barth's lecture and saying, you know, to Karl Barth, I would take up arms against the Nazis, and Yoder standing up and saying, Jesus wouldn't do that. I mean, what a great story.
Yep. So fun. So interesting to hear. And I was also just taken with the fact that Schenck could tell these stories as a colleague, a friend of Bosch, of Neubingen. Not just a contemporary, but someone in the trenches with them, in the sort of initial conceptualization of the missional theology that has begun, one might hope, to permeate the landscape of Western Christianity. It's just cool to hear the behind the scenes stuff, as always.
Agreed. So one of the questions that, one of the questions that I was asking myself as we were, you know, kind of thinking through Wilbert Schenck and his, as I was reflecting, I should say, on his work and the interview itself, there's a couple of questions, and maybe we can engage right now. One of them is, what is his major contribution? He points out the contributions of many others, and part of me is wondering, what about his major, contribution? The other question that came up was, what do we do about John Howard Yoder and his fall from grace, right? I mean, that was another question that came up for me. Is, here is an Anabaptist missiologist, an Anabaptist theologian of mission, and who's helping really think through culture and I mean, so in so many ways you can see the conversation that's been going on within that Anabaptist Mennonite specifically circle, and the way that it's influenced Schenck. I had the privilege of taking a course with Schenck back in 2010. It was one of his last courses, Contemporary Culture. I think it was referred to as I think the title was Mission in Contemporary Culture. But anyway, that was one of the questions that came up for me. One of the other questions that came up, maybe we can address this one too, Greg, and feel free to jump in with whichever one you'd like to address. But the other one that came up was the question of, how do you feel about the implicit critique behind the hope, right? So he had a major hope and had to do with the centrality of mission theology, or the lack of centrality, the lack of addressing missional theology in Western theological education. So anyway, those are the questions that kind of came up for me. And I don't know, which one would you like to tackle first?
I want to clear the deck with Yoder. I think we start there with the diciest part of this conversation. It's somewhat risky territory, and
yeah,
for that reason necessary. And so I'm happy to jump in there. So, you know, for us, there is some risk of credibility. There's some risk of legitimacy in not mentioning Yoder and the circumstances that surround his fall from grace.
His sexual abuse. I mean, it was confirmed cases of sexual abuse against students.
That's right.
Right. So this is an asymmetrical relationship. And, you know, this is somebody that's taking advantage of that in the midst of some, you know, power dynamics. It's serious, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, what do we do about that? I mean, do we just ignore, or do we not cite the influence of Yoder in our lives and in our theology? How do we go about this?
Yeah, and I think Shank's a useful example of this. You know, he didn't feel the need to mention that. And yet the interview's about his life, and there's just no way to cut Yoder's influence out of his life.
Right.
You can't pretend like it's not there.
Yep.
I think it's foolish to try to pretend like Yoder's influence isn't there, and in some ways mediated by Shank in missional theology.
Right. Yep.
It's there, yep. You know, yep. And it's not that you just go, oh, well, we'll, instead of turning to Yoder for that, we'll turn to someone else. He has original ideas.
Yep.
He has perspectives that no one else articulated in the way that he did, and that remain, I think, very important for missional ecclesiology. And so, you know, in part, it's just dishonest to try to blot out Yoder's influence. But it's also not sufficient to just sort of do a little asterisk, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This isn't a Major League Baseball record with a little asterisk on it that indicates, you know, some sort of
Like the Dodgers won, but they won during COVID, so it doesn't really count. I mean, it wasn't
right. Or the Astros won, but under the cloud of cheating.
Right, right. There you go.
Whatever it is.
Probably,
you know,
a better example that in this case. Yeah.
So what is sufficient? You know, and this is a methodological question for missiology. I mean, we're not talking about this just to cover ourselves in this podcast and say, hey, we're doing due diligence here.
Yep.
In order to keep ourselves clean of some sort of implicit affirmation of Yoder's conduct. Rather, we need to tackle this issue. What do you do? I mean, Bart, it's funny that the story is about Yoder and Bart. Bart has also become the focus of scandal because of his marital infidelity. And what are you going to do with 20th century theology? You're just not going to footnote Bart anymore?
Right.
So no, you can't do that. Yeah. So then what do you do?
Yeah.
What's the appropriate, does every single work that addresses or that utilizes Bart's work or Yoder's work need to have some sort of initial footnote that, you know, makes a caveat, makes an acknowledgement of the problem. What's useful here? And I think this is really important for missiology in particular, Martin, because this is only one instance of a wider principle. And
that's,
I think,
right.
The struggle, yes, is to figure out where to draw the line, because it's not as though these sexual sins or marital infidelity, abuse of specific relationships are the only kinds of abusive, problematic, deeply hurtful relationships in mission.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this is the struggle of all decolonial missiology.
Yeah.
Are we to disregard or somehow always put that asterisk by the insights of missionaries and missiologists who have always been
during the colonial period, right?
They've always been caught up in problematic relationships, have always seen partially and acted badly in some ways. Where's the line? Right. What do you think? Is there a line?
I'm sure that the line is not really. This is one of those. It's going to take discernment and a community thinking through this. So my mentors, Mark Lau Branson, practical theologian, and Juan Martinez, also practical theologian, at Fuller in my dissertation, encouraged me, and especially Juan encouraged me. You know what? Don't build on Yoder. You cannot expose yourself to that kind of critique right now. And this is in the midst of. This is not post Me Too movement. This is in the midst of, right. So that's. And he was just like, there are other things that are going on within your argument. Focus on those. And I think he did it out of like a deep concern for me, right? I mean, he's wanting me to avoid that kind of ungracious, I guess it's that ungracious kind of witch hunting that's become part of our culture, it feels like, in a lot of these conversations, right? You cited him, so, and you didn't explicitly tell us that, you disagree with these things that he did, and so...
Yeah, you now have to say that you think sexual abuse of students by professors is a bad thing.
Right.
If you don't say that, then you obviously don't think it's a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is that the question you're bringing up, right, the connection you're making is so important, because our history as a church is also filled with crimes and oppressions and abuses of power, right? What are we going to do with all of that? We're working in a house that is full of skeletons and if we go around putting asterisks on everything, I mean, we're never going to get to our dissertation,
Well, or just deleting things, right? I mean, you have there are programs now that banish the classics from the curriculum because, of course, they're all caught up in systems of male patriarchy, and so fair enough. Like, there's critique that is necessary all the way through the practices and history and theory of mission, all the way through. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Is there no way to retrieve the insights of the fallible? And I think that you have to answer that question eventually if you are a Christian who affirms that there's no such thing as a theologian who isn't fallible.
Yeah.
And eventually it's going to come down to the fine point of saying, well, here are the kinds of sins and failings that corrupt every possible thing that this person might have said. And here's the class of sins that don't do that. And they don't merit dismissal. And then maybe here's the class that merits some sort of asterisk. And that seems to me to be a perilous path to take. I just don't know how to get there. So I'm still puzzled, Martin. I just don't know what to do exactly. I just know I'm not satisfied with.
There's no easy answers. Yeah. We can certainly say there's no easy answers, right? I think that, sometimes it's probably appropriate to put the asterisks in there and say, listen, like, let's just be upfront. Like, Yoder, I love his theology, and there are aspects of his, broken, hurting, missing the mark humanity and life in the world and abuses of power that I don't agree with. And I think of David Fitch, I think of his faithful presence, and he builds on Yoder on a regular basis. And I can say that, when did that come out? That was like,
16, 17. Okay.
Yeah, 16, you got it. And so you have, a book that was very much a blessing for me, and he's citing Yoder all over the place, and I personally was not distracted by his lack of an asterisk in there. I mean, since we're using that as a metaphor now, right? But I was still very much blessed by a book that's talking about practices. And it's hard to talk about practices as a Mennonite and not talk about Yoder, who did a great job of connecting a missional ecclesiology with, you know, this with a focus on practices.
Yeah. So in some ways, it's a question of maybe a Christian practice of retrieval. We need to figure out how best to integrate our theological retrieval of legitimate insights and necessary concepts, and integrate that with repentance and confession, mm-hmm. and a humility about the ways in which our embodied life as theologians, as practitioners, yields fruit of yes. more than one kind.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And that, as you said, that calls for discernment, but yeah, I suppose, a retrieval, a repentant kind of retrieval where we have to bear the burden of confession and
yeah.
insisting yeah. on a different way while also receiving what blessings there are in our fragile, broken interlocutors.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that maybe it makes it a little bit harder for me with Yoder is that a lot of the reasons that I love his theology are related to his engagement with voices that are less powerful, right? They're closer to the quote unquote margins of the conversations, right? And so there's an aspect of it that, you know, his particular fall from grace, it's like it works against that, like directly. And I think that's maybe for me one of the challenges there. But again, it's hard to underestimate how important John Howard Yoder is. If we're talking about the development of, you know, this missional ecclesiologies, and we're going to trace the development, the history of this missional church conversation in the West, I mean, it's the Anabaptist traditions. They were the ones that were consistently challenging the state church connection. And I think it's important to kind of name that, the seeds maybe for the development of later mission theology is very much, and who are those people that were critiquing Christendom all the way along? You know, that it was the Anabaptists, right? And so they ended up with this an ecclesiology that is, you know, where the church is both a paradigm and an instrument, of reconciliation, of God's work in the world, but acting as witnesses including to the state. This is a little bit off topic, but I just preached a sermon on Sunday. July 4th. And I approach July 4th and sermons on July 4th with, they're hard for me. I grew up in another country. I feel very much, as much as I feel allegiance to this country, I feel allegiance to the country where I grew up in Mexico, and in a sense of belonging, that sense of kind of loyalty, you know, if you want to call it patriotism, there's a twofoldness for me. So anyway, when I'm thinking through these questions, though, how do I do a sermon on July 4th, where I'm asking people to pay attention, to be a little bit more suspicious about those narratives, those national narratives that are informing our imagination and shaping us as people. And, you know, and for me, Yoder is significant in that conversation. I mean, he's one of the voices, via Richard Hughes, because it was Richard Hughes that really introduced me to Yoder, and it was through his classes that I first I guess I first came into contact with an ecclesiology that made sense for a person that was transnational like me, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas it made sense where, you know, yes, we are deeply engaged, and yet it's a tentative engagement. Man, and the Anabaptists have had, you know, that's been a strength of theirs all the way along. And you see that strength in Wilbert Shank's own scholarship and in his own career. You can see that strength.
Yeah. And that's what I would say to in response to one of your other questions about what's his contribution. I mean, I appreciated the humility with which he sort of evaded that question from you.
Right.
And his response was essentially, look, I'm so deeply interdisciplinary that I haven't made a contribution per se. And I think, as he put it, he wasn't the one to generate intellectual capital. He was more of a guide. Mm-hmm. And I, as much as I love the humility, I just want to call that one bull and just point out that, like, look, the stories he's telling about his early involvement in the Gospel in Our Culture program, and then secondarily in the States, the Gospel in Our Culture Network,
yep,
which is the womb from which missional ecclesiology emerges, Newbegin's thought, and then Guder's leadership on the other side of the pond. If Anabaptist theology is part and parcel of missional ecclesiology, it's because Wilbert Shank was a key early component of its development.
Yeah. Yep.
And I don't know how much he would claim credit for that, but I see it. I loved hearing some of the inside stories and some of how those connections initially formed, because I didn't know that. But my perception has always been that Shank in particular, and then a couple of other key Anabaptist participants in the Gospel in Our Culture Network are the ones who mediated what I take to be one of the two primary alternatives within missional ecclesiology, the other being a sort of neo-reformed Kuyperian ecclesiology, such as that espoused by Michael Goheen and so on. And so the fact that David Fitch's neo-Anabaptist missional ecclesiology is as powerful an influence as it is within the realm of that literature and practice,
yep,
I think Wilbert Shank is a key to that development.
Yeah. Yeah. So as you think about all of those different, you know, kind of major streams in the conversation, where do you land yourself?
Well, you know, as you said, in our tradition, in Churches of Christ, the Restoration Movement, Richard Hughes has played a significant role, I would say, nationally in kind of calling us back to an affinity, an original affinity with Anabaptist theology. And so I'm much more at home there, although I've felt the need to temper the neo-Anabaptist vision with something that's at home, I would say, neither in the Restoration Movement nor much in missional ecclesiology, which is a liberationist bent.
Yes.
And so, although I often feel that neo-Anabaptist and liberationist theology are sort of like oil and water in some aspects, it's the combination of the two alone that I discover myself as a theologian. And so,
yeah,
and so
yeah,
somehow I'm a neo-Anabaptist liberationist. I don't know how that works on top of being a restorationist, but there you have it.
I love it. That's great. You know, when I think about his contribution, I think about Wilbert Shank, and I think about the things that, so I'm thinking of the works of his that I read. So it's not just his critique of Bosch that was really significant. It's other, you know, I think it's Casting the Vision. Is that the name of one of his?
Write the Vision.
Writing the Vision. Thank you. Yes. Writing the Vision. His essay, Recasting Theology of Mission. And so much of his work is about listening. And we brought the, I mean, I brought this up in the interview itself, but his.
Yes, you were perceptive in the moment as usual.
Yeah, but he brought up, I mean, all the way through, he's constantly advocating for us to listen to non-Western voices. Traditional European North American curriculum, right? Theologians. He's mm-hmm. asking us to, to think through our conceptions of Missio Dei and to construct them in ways that are attentive to non-Western voices and also, maybe even putting them at the center, right? Like let's make you, and you can sense his frustration with David Bosch in that, right? Like these should have been at the center, and they weren't. And maybe that's not a fair critique, and maybe that's not true. But I love that theme of let's listen to folks. Let's reflect on the challenges of mission and let's do it with our non-Western brothers and sisters that are doing theology and thinking through these things. And maybe they have insights on even thinking through ourselves. So Wilbert Shank's own work has so much to do with, thinking through mission and culture and engagement in the West. Mm-hmm. And what I appreciate then is it's someone from that stance, right? That's focused on how is it that we can be, how can the West be converted? And he's thinking about it and asking, well, what would non-Western voices say about how the West should be converted?
Right.
It's a great question. He did that consistently. And I appreciate that about Shank's career.
Well, and that was, a direct product of his experiences in Java.
Yes. Yes.
And being discipled, being taught by, being corrected by a Javanese church leader. And you hear the respect and admiration, yes, that he has for this man.
Yeah.
And that I think that primary experience is reflected through, I mean, there's a, as you pointed out, there's an Anabaptist affinity for the margins anyway. That's where Anabaptists have always lived. And so maybe they're, because of that, more attentive, they're better listeners to begin with.
Right,
but then
right.
This experience in mission, I think, set a trajectory for Shank in some way. And thank God for that.
That's right. Thank God for a mentor that was on the ground thinking through the big questions that continue to be the center of this field of study, this missiology conversation. And I agree. I love that story. I love that his first person that he names when he's thinking about experiences that have shaped him. I appreciate the fact that it wasn't David Bosch, even though I love.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been doing interviews now for these interviews and asking this question. Tell me about a primary experience, and I tell me about people specifically, engagements, right, conversations that have shaped you. And I love that people answer David Bosch, right? I love that people mm-hmm. are answering that the folks that with the guests that we've had, but I also, there's something unique and there's something really special about Dr. Shank saying it was a man who mentored me and showed me the questions that matter and how to engage them. So here we go, Greg, the last question that we wanted to engage has to do with, well, did you experience a big gap in your education? I mean, so part of his hope and part of his, it's, I want to see, missiology, missional theology become not be on the margins of theological education, right? This needs to be at the center of the conversation.
Yeah. Well, he asks just for a serious hearing.
Yeah.
Right. His contention is it still doesn't even get a serious hearing quote, theological education institutions.
Yeah.
Or the theological education institution. So you get this capital I institution sort of a thing there.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question then is, Greg, have you experienced that? And your so thinking about your own theological education that, you know, you're wrapping things up with your dissertation, and not to stress you out, but when are you going to be wrapping that up?
That's hateful, man.
Yeah, that was hateful. Super mean. That was super mean. We'll definitely edit that out of the final version of this.
I'm going to leave that in so everybody knows.
No. Okay. Well, it's this is a voice from the margins, Greg. When are you going to?
I'm sorry. So, I'm listening.
So, how has your theological education either given or failed to give a serious hearing to the mission of God?
Okay, so personally, my bachelor's degree was in missions, and so maybe it's hard to state from that perspective how legitimate a hearing missions gets, because I'm in the middle of it, but
you're reading all the books.
It's a bachelor's degree with a pretty wide array of required courses, and so I can say that my focus on missions was contained to missions courses.
Or
restricted to missions courses, right? And so it's not as though I'm going into any other aspect of the theological curriculum and hearing word one about mission, much less experiencing, you know, a missional theological framework or something. So there's the traditional siloing of theological disciplines that's at work there. And I think that there's no reason to claim that at this juncture that has been overcome. I work for a school that has revised its entire Bible department curriculum in order to embrace a missional framework.
Which is amazing, by the way. That is so cool. But how often does that happen?
Yeah, I can't say that that's typical. It's not like I know. It's not like I've investigated, you know, a sample of comparable schools across the country or something. But my sense is that that's an unusual, hopeful, but not representative move on the part of Lipscomb's Department of Bible and Ministry. And so
I think you can speak with a little bit more authority, though. When you say that it is not representative within our brotherhood, we're thinking about our brotherhood and the conversations that we have with other folks within the Restoration Movement, Churches of Christ. This is not representative.
No.
This is a very legitimate critique that's coming from Shank. You know, that's grounded in a deep hope, right? That every congregation will learn to see itself and understand itself as an embassy. And, you know, our leaders will be trained in a theology that is constantly coming back to what's God doing in the world? What's God doing? You know, how's God present? How's God working? What about your PhD? What about later education?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I went to Fuller. So the integration is there. It's also definitely not the case that in my, let's say, my theological methods class, which is sort of the initial systematic theology proper class that anybody with that emphasis has to take. It's not as though that sort of a survey of the whole field of theology is in particular emphasizing or even much acknowledging missional theology as a major contender methodologically. There's that sense in which we acknowledge and recognize the need to dialogue with people coming from many different places, and people are still coming from many different places. But at the same time, my study, my writing, my engagement, even with the School of Intercultural Studies, as a systematic theologian at Fuller is characterized, I mean, I think probably to the maximum extent by engagement with missional theology, and there's been no problem there, no friction, no pushback. It's at home in that sense. But I don't think, again, I don't think Fuller is representative in that sense. Mm-hmm. I think it's a phenomenally high quality scholarly experience, the PhD program there. Mm-hmm. And I think it should be compared to other top flight doctoral programs, apples to apples. But I don't think that that comparison would reveal that other programs also much make room for missional theology as a sort of a methodological given.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I'll be honest, my initial kind of reaction when I heard that was, really? But then you're making me think through the fact that I too have, well, certainly my PhD, right? A PhD right. in missiology, intercultural studies, it's all about missional ecclesiologies and all about, you know, thinking through, anyway, it's missiology through and through. And yet both of my mentors, Mark Lau Branson and Juan Martinez, are, you know, they're doing practical theology, and they refer to themselves. We are practical theologians. We're not missiologists, right? This is practical theology. So they have, it's hard to read Mark Lau Branson and miss, you know, God's presence and activity in the world. I mean, it shapes his entire praxis, their entire praxis. And so in a sense, I'm thinking through it. I'm like, really? Cause I, at least in my education with these particular mentors, and that's what you're making me realize right now, is that, you know, maybe in many ways, Branson and Martinez are not representative, and maybe even, you know, they're part of, if we're going to talk about those silos, they're part of a practical theology department, and we've always been on the margins of those conversations, those broader conversations in theology. I mean, we as in practical theologians, and you know, we're the that like secondary field, right? The one that nobody really wants to acknowledge is there, yeah. But we're there. And at least for me, it's a lot of the practical theology that I've been exposed to has been very much at least conversant with missional ecclesiologies. But yeah, that it's not true across the board. Certainly not.
Well, I think what your anecdote there highlights is that, even at its best, even where it's most at home, missional theology is still running up against these old distinctions.
Yeah.
And in some sense, there's still a tacit admission among, say, practical theologians that, well, what we're not engaged with is foreign missions, or that cross-cultural over there stuff that we still put the label of missions proper on, precisely contrary to the claim that missional theology was trying to make, which was that, no, actually,
yep,
all the stuff over here is mission too. And that's a misuse of the term. It's a misunderstanding of what it means for the triune God to be present among all people at all times. Mm-hmm. And so that battle, I would say, just clearly hasn't been finished.
Yep.
But it also highlights the question for me: what does Schenck think mission having a hearing actually looks like? What does that mean?
Hmm.
And I'm not sure. I'm not sure we got a clear sense from the interview of what it would look like for the capital I institution of theological education in North America to give mission a hearing. But it sounded like what he was focused on was perhaps the practical preparation of local ministers.
That's right. Right. How does the mission of God relate embassies. To what you're doing in leadership? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so in some sense, there's actually a screening out there of sort of the academic ivory tower question of who's doing missional theology in their books, and a focus instead on which programs in the theological education institution are preparing ministers to go into their contexts in missional ways. Mm-hmm. And boy, I think he's probably right. There's just not enough of that kind of preparation yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like a lot of the sermons that I'm hearing, they talk about the Missio Dei more and more. And so one of the guys that I've kind of kept up with a little bit when I like sermons, it's a guy named J.D. Greer. And I like his sermons. I like his messages. He's a funny guy, but he just usually works kind of verse by verse and works his way through things. But he's at the Summit Church, so this would be in North Carolina, and where my brother. And so my brother used to go to this church before he moved back to Southern California. And so anyway, this is one of those guys that I just kind of kept up with, and I've noticed an increased. Maybe over the last 5 years, it's just more and more. And this is a mega church, right? This is a very large, it has Baptist roots, but I'm thinking about people like him, that, you know, they're engaging these questions a lot more than they ever have. And maybe he too is an exception, but I hear a lot more missional church, kind of conversations, even just in sermons, from guys that I like. I mean, guys like, I don't know. Well, of course, Christopher Wright. he's at All Souls. And I love listening to his sermons. But I don't know. What do you think about that, Greg? Do you feel like this is something that mission theology is getting a more serious hearing now among, you know, local leadership in the local church?
I think... there are a great number of useful texts that leaders in local churches are probably attending to, things like Faithful Presence, things like Scott McKnight's work, which frequently engages with missional theology, you know, things like Roxborough and Goheen. And I mean, there's a lot out there that is written, I think, for that audience, for local pastoral leaders.
One of the benefit. Ones that comes to mind for me is Slow Church.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So Christopher Smith and John Patterson.
Great book. Great
you know,
book.
So Cultivating Community in the Patient Way of Jesus, their first two chapters very much engage a lot of these themes. But anyway, where were you going with that? That you were talking
well,
about
and so books. I think there's a lot out there that's probably influencing widely. But I'm not sure, insofar as the majority of pastoral leaders are shaped by things like MDiv programs,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how equipped the majority are to think in these terms, or how aware they are of this sort of literature. But you know, maybe social media and the breadth of discourse and accessibility that the internet affords has hastened the influence of missional theology in ways that I don't yet perceive. My sense is still that if I just randomly point at any given church in my city, it's more likely than not that this framing isn't the major concern, if you know what I mean.
That's it's worth an article at some point, Greg. We're gonna have to start thinking through how much has this influenced, right? I mean, where is Shank's hope gonna be most when it changes, when is it going to, where is it going to be changing the most? You know, it's going to be shaping things and reshaping them the most. What aspects of theological education, what aspects of our, you know, our engagement as local churches?
Yeah. Where is the need and what does its fulfillment look like?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great job on the interview, Martin. Thanks again for delivering that to us and the riches of that conversation. Very much appreciated.
Thank you, Dr. Shank, again, for your time and for all of your work, for all of your listening that you've done over the years.
Absolutely. Okay, well, that's it for this post-game episode. Thanks so much for tuning in. We always appreciate your feedback, and so lay it on us.
That's right. We want to hear from you, and we would love for you to share our stuff and get folks into this conversation.
Yeah, hopefully we said something in here that's provocative. I think there's a couple things that probably set someone off. So, talk to us. Tell me how I'm wrong.
Yeah, yeah. We certainly brought up provocative things. I mean, we started out with John Howard Yoder. Do we use him or not? Right.
And then also, if you want to defend me against Martin's hateful question
about when he's going to be done with his dissertation, yeah, feel free.
Yeah.
Feel free. Send the hate mail. Send it.
Actually, I need support. I need moral support. Okay. Well, let's leave it there, brother.
Sounds good.
All right. We'll catch you on the next one. Take care.
Bye-bye.